And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues. And I just heard an announcement today that Schiff has decided he's going to go ahead and try to impeach the vice president. Because he might have known somebody who knew somebody who heard that conversation the president had with the Ukrainians. And then, of course, that would make Nancy Pelosi the president. And I'm sure in her gratitude, she'd make Schiff vice president. And then they could run in 2020. Be the blind leading the blind. Well, we continue to talk about missing persons. And some cases are just downright weird. For example, let's talk about the Kinross case. The evening of November 23rd, 1953, it was winter. There was a mix of snow flurries and sleet over the dark waters of Lake Superior. U.S. Air Force radar operators at an isolated base on the Michigan Peninsula picked up a mysterious blip on their scopes. Well, ground control intercept officer noticed the unknown aircraft was zooming low over Sioux Locks, a restricted flying area located along the windswept shores of Lake Superior. He determined that there was no known flight scheduled near that off-limits region. Whatever that mysterious object was, didn't have any business being there, and it had to be identified and dealt with. So that job fell to 27-year-old First Lieutenant Felix Moncla, an experienced Air Force pilot. He had more than 1,000 flying hours, and a former medical student who'd served in the last days of World War II and occupied Japan. He was a native of Morroville, Louisiana. Well, he was contacted, suited up, and raced to his F-89C Scorpion jet fighter. Strapped in behind him was his radar observer, Second Lieutenant Robert Wilson from Oklahoma. Both men were on temporary assignment at Kinross Airfield in Michigan. That was a small base located just south of Sault Ste. Marie on the Canadian-American border. But both were very familiar with that region. Well, Moncliffe fired up his jet and took off. Seconds later, after getting more instructions from Defense Command about the location of that mysterious target, his F-89C Scorpion flew out into the dark, cold December night and flew off for a meeting with the unknown. Less than half an hour later, the jet's crew would make contact with an unknown object before they mysteriously disappeared over the waters of Lake Superior, never to be seen again. In time, the what became known as the Kinross File had become one of the most celebrated cases in the annals of UFO lore. Exactly what happened to that F-89C Scorpion Interceptor and its crew that night, shortly before Thanksgiving, over the black waters of Lake Superior, is still a mystery to this day. Now, the action began shortly before midnight on the night of November 23rd when Air Defense Command radar detected this unidentified target. It was said to be about 200 miles out over the Lake Superior. Unknown aircraft had entered restricted airspace and had to be identified. 2 minutes later, Moncla and Wilson were flying toward the locks aboard a supersonic F-89C. For its time, quite a sophisticated aircraft. Guided by ground control, the pair of airmen climbed steeply, their jet plunging ever faster toward their target. Back at ground control intercept, the controller watched the jet's blip on his radar scope. As it moved toward the unknown object's blip, that strange craft changed course. The controller quickly radioed Moncla and gave him the new bearing. And from the glowing green scope, the controller saw Moncla's F-89C was now rapidly soaring over Sault Ste. Marie. From the jet's cockpit, the lights of the city would have appeared as a misty blur. They were going so fast. The unidentified object flying as fast as a jet airliner was moving in a crazy zigzag pattern across Lake Superior. At over 500 miles an hour, the F-89C raced after it. They closed over Whitefish Bay. 9 more minutes ticked by that fateful night in the tense quiet of the GCI radar room. Gradually, Mokla's jet angled in on the enigmatic blip, eventually closing the gap. The controller realized by now that radar observer Wilson aboard the intercept jet should have spotted the quarry on the fighter's short-range radar. Monitoring the chase from the warmth of the command center, the controller clicked on his microphone and called the flight code's name. Target should be visual, he said, still bearing. At that point, the controller broke off, staring in horror at the radar scope. The two blips, one representing Moncla's F-89C and the other the unknown object, had merged into one. Well, maybe the strange machine had slowed down or Moncla had unaccountably thrust to full power. Amid the glowing radar screens and flickering lights of the control panel, nobody following the chase inside the dimly lit CGI could determine with certainty what had just happened. One thing, though, was eminently clear. The two aircraft were locked together as if they had rapidly maneuvered themselves on a straight collision course. The controller thought Moncla's jet had flown either under or over the strange object. That would account for the single flashing blip. Any second, he expected the two to separate. And for a moment longer, this huge, ominous blip remained on the glass. And then as the controller watched, it took off and vanished off the scope. Well, marking the position, the controller realized there was only one thing to do now. He picked up the phone and called search and rescue, which was standing by. A pair of officers aboard the F-89C had probably noticed the impending collision and bailed out over the waters of Lake Superior. Now, both had life jackets, both had self-inflating rafts, but the controller knew they could survive in the frigid conditions only so long. As best the controller could determine, the mystery craft and the F-89C had come together far offshore, about 100 miles northwest of Sault Ste. Marie and several miles from Coulinaw Point. Minutes later, American and Canadian search planes and helicopters were roaring over Lake Superior and searching the darkness for the missing airmen. Naval and Coast Guard ships shortly followed, slashing through the fog and icy breakers in the direction of the reported crash site. Well, turning to the official United States Air Force accident report, it said the aircraft took off at 2322 Zebra, 23 November 1953, on an active air defense mission to intercept an unknown aircraft about 160 miles northwest of Kinross Air Force Base. The aircraft was under radar control throughout the interception. At approximately 2352 Zebra, the last radio contact was made by the radar station controlling the interception. At approximately 2355 Zebra, the unknown aircraft and the F-89 merged together on the radar scope. Shortly after that, the IFF signal disappeared. No further contact was established with the F-89. Extensive aerial search revealed no trace of the aircraft. The craft and its crew are still missing. Well, as outlined in the official after-action accident report, no trace of the jet fighter or its two-man crew was ever found. In words of a retired Major Donald Kehoe, a leading researcher who spent years studying the mysterious incident, it was as if they had vanished into the unknown. Now, First Lieutenant Felix Eugene Moncla, Jr., Gene as his friends called him, had joined the Air Force 3 years earlier to fly jets. The pilot had quickly mastered several models, but felt most at home behind the controls of Northrop's new F-89C Scorpion Interceptor. That was the latest version of the F-89 series. He and Second Lieutenant Wilson, an Oklahoman, worked well together, even though Wilson, for some strange reason, was having technical trouble with his radar system that night above Lake Superior. Born October 31st, 1926 in Monroeville, Louisiana. My uncle graduated from Southwest Louisiana Institute. That's now Loyola at Lafayette, Louisiana, where he played football and got his Bachelor of Science degree. Son of a science teacher and a seamstress, he enlisted first in the U.S. Army and served during World War II and occupied Japan. After service, he attended the School of Medicine at Louisiana State University, probably on the GI Bill, but re-enlisted in the military at the start of the Korean War in 50, this time in the U.S. Air Force as an officer pilot trainee. Well, he spent time in Dallas, Texas, before transferring to Connolly Air Force Base in Waco, Texas. It was there he attended basic pilot training. It was also there he met and married Bobby Jean Coleman. At Reese Air Force Base in Lubbock, he received advanced pilot training and further polished his aviation skills on the F-89C Scorpion at Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida. It was there that Bobby Jean gave birth to their first son in July of 1952. That same month, Monklin and his family moved to Madison, Wisconsin. After settling in, his wife gave birth to a daughter. 5 months later, while stationed at Kinross Airfield on temporary assignment, the young aviator would vanish in one of the most mysterious episodes in aviation history. The Kinross case, as it's called, named after the small Air Force base, focuses on the strange and still unresolved disappearance of the lieutenant as radar operator, who had scrambled their jet that night to intercept the unknown object over Lake Superior. Well, Kinross Air Force Base, the closest facility to the scene where the unknown craft was first tracked, had quickly alerted Moncla's 433rd Fighter Interception Squadron at Trox Field near Madison in Dane County, Wisconsin. Moncla and radar observer Wilson had the duty that night, so they were tapped to go check out whatever this mysterious object was. Well, they suited up, got aboard their jet to give chase, and entered the annals of aviation mystery. What happened that dark, cold night in the skies over Lake Superior remains an enigma. Something that possibly involves one of the earliest known encounters between a military aircraft and the unidentified flying object that most believe came from another world. Piece of my equipment came loose. There we go. Very good. Well, ever since that evening, investigators have tried to get to the bottom of the unexplained incident. But over 60 years later, it's still a mystery. Available U.S. Air Force records show that F-89 was vectored west-northwest, then west, climbing to 30,000 feet. And while on its westerly course, the crew received permission to descend to 7,000 feet, turning east-northeast and coming steeply down on the target from above. But as the aircraft closed in on that mysterious object, it subsequently vanished into oblivion, along with the crew. That F-89C had dropped to an elevation of 8,000 feet when it seemed to fully merge with the other aerial object. It was expected to in an interception scenario. Surprisingly, the pursuing jet's intercept signal also disappeared when the two aircraft merged on the radar scope. That was not expected. Although efforts to contact the F-89C crew were unsuccessful, the pilot of another F-89C was sent to check on the mishap, and he stated in testimony to the accident board that he believed he'd heard Moncla's Cajun drawl in a brief radio transmission about 40 minutes after the plane supposedly disappeared. So what happened to the two crewmen and their multi-million dollar F-89C Scorpion? Well, The most likely theory, according to Air Force investigators, is that Monkley experienced vertigo and crashed into the lake at 500 miles an hour. Man, I give you a case of whiplash. The Louisianan reportedly did have a history of suffering from vertigo. One Air Force report suggested the experienced pilot might have been hit with an attack of vertigo a little more than a normal degree, and of course, civilian investigators disputed that. Statements about the pilot's condition made by former members of Monkley's organization have been questioned by a number of American and Canadian investigators who contend they should not have considered as firsthand evidence. Instead, stories about vertigo probably should be regarded as hearsay and not part of the official records. Should also be pointed out that pilot vertigo is not listed as a cause or probable cause in any of the Air Force Accident Investigation Board's official findings and conclusions. And from everything I can find out, it's not supported by his military medical record either. Harvard University astronomer and UFO debunker Donald Menzel accepted the Air Force position regarding Monkley's vertigo problem, adding that the radar operators probably saw a phantom echo of the F-89 produced by atmospheric conditions that merged with the radar return from the jet and vanished with it when the plane struck the water. Well, it's all well and good for ivory tower scientists to come up with all these theories. Problem is, none of them have anything to back them up other than scientific supposition. In other words, a guess. For its own part, the Air Force eventually concluded the unknown aircraft that Monkley was chasing was a Royal Canadian Air Force C-47. And that the pilot of the F-89C had identified it as such as he closed in but then crashed, probably as a result of vertigo after abandoning the chase. The only problem with that theory is that in both 1961 and 1963, the Royal Canadian Air Force vigorously denied to the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, or NICAP, that the object had been one of its C-47s. You see, military investigators are under the gun to solve investigations as quickly as possible, and not to leave anything hanging about that might result in a suit by the family. Now, if they pointed the finger at a Canadian aircraft as the reason that Monkley was in the air, and then it was one of his own medical problems that caused the crash, the government's off the hook. The problem is, the evidence doesn't support it. The Air Force official accident report states that when the unknown object's return, or the blip, on the radar screen was first picked up, it was believed to be an aircraft belonging to the Royal Canadian Air Force identified as VC-912. The Canadian aircraft was classified as unknown because it was off its flight plan course by about 30 miles. Now, that assertion was denied by the pilot of the craft in question, Gerald Fosberg, when he was interviewed for the David Chernak documentary, The Monkley Memories, produced for Vision TV's Enigma series. U.S. Air Force also provided an alternative explanation to UFO investigator Major Donald Kehoe. In his 1955 book, The Flying Saucer Conspiracy, Kehoe describes his investigation into the F-89 disappearance, which began the night of the incident when he got a phone call telling him of a rumor out at Selridge Field that an F-89 from Kinross was hit by a flying saucer. More than likely, it was taken by a flying saucer. Well, a follow-up telephone call to Public Information Officer Lieutenant Robert White revealed the unknown in that case was a Canadian DC-3. It's over the locks by mistake. Well, exactly what did happen that night remains a mystery, just as the Air Force acknowledges. However, serious unanswered questions remain, according to the author and UFO researcher Richard Hall. One of the questions he asked the Air Force never could answer, how likely is it that a pilot would suffer from vertigo and flying on instruments, as official records indicate was the case? He said, if an F-89 did intercept an RCAF C-47, why did the blip of the C-47 also vanish off the radar scope? And why did the Air Force invoke a Canadian C-47 when the Royal Canadian Air Force spokesman later stated it wasn't there? The Air Force was wrong. According to Hall, no intelligence document has yet surfaced that reports the radio communication between the pilot and the radar controllers and what each was seeing. Without that little bit of information, he says it's impossible to evaluate the true UFO versus the false radar returns and accidental crash explanations. And then there's another interesting bit of speculation that I've seen. Only 5 hours prior to the disappearance of the F-89, another F-89 from Trox Field, this one piloted by First Lieutenant John Smith and radar operator Captain Glenn Collins, crashed on the shores of Lake Wingra, about 400 miles from the site of the crash at Lake Superior. According to Nick Redfern, who's written quite a number of books on mysteries of this sort, a base officer at Trox Field, Colonel Shoup, said he was convinced the men in the first F-89 crash had stuck with their plane in an attempt to keep from crashing into densely occupied areas of Madison. Well, Redfern added that officials investigating the first crash believed that a sudden mechanical failure caused the two occupants of the plane no opportunity to radio base or in distress or even a bailout of their speeding aircraft. And maybe this event was indeed a tragic accident resulting from nothing stranger than a mechanical failure. However, taking into consideration a strange second incident that occurred only 5 hours later over Lake Superior and involving personnel from the same military base and in the same type of aircraft, an open mind should be kept on the possibility there was a connection, even if it is one that remains unresolved. And Lieutenant Felix Monclas Jr.'s tiny hometown of Moreauville, Louisiana, which is in the bend of the Avilés Parish bordering the state of Mississippi, citizens have erected a gleaming stone memorial in honor of Gene, located in Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery. This impressive memorial rests on a bronze plaque beneath the outstretched arms of Christ on the cross. The inscription reads, in memory of Gene, disappeared November 23, 1953, intercepting a UFO over Canadian border as pilot of a Northrop F-89 plane. A family and old friends still want to know what happened to the popular young boy who grew up to become a jet fighter pilot. One of those people's Gordon Heath, a computer systems analyst who hails from British Columbia. He investigates strange phenomena, writes for UFO journals. He spent years searching for the truth behind the Kinross incident and is of the opinion the Air Force is actually hiding something. Interview with journalist Andrew Griffin, a staff writer for Town Talk newspaper in Moreauville, he pointed out numerous errors in the official Air Force version of what happened that night. Commenting on the claim that Monclas suffered from vertigo problems, Heath wondered why the Air Force would have him on active duty flying critical missions if that was really the case. Just doesn't make sense, he said, insisting that the vertigo theory is weak because Monclas was using instruments to fly that night rather than flying visually. And the Royal Canadian Air Force disputed the U.S. Air Force theory the object Monclas was chasing was a Royal Canadian Air Force aircraft flying a night mission from Winnipeg, Manitoba to Sudbury, Ontario. And also later claims by the Air Force that Monclas' Cajun drawl was heard over the radio long after his plane had reportedly gone down and clashed with their own original version of the story. Following the crash, it'd be a month before Monclas, radar operator Wilson officially listed as dead by the Air Force. And surprisingly, the Air Force didn't hold a memorial for the two crewmen, as was the custom for members who died in the line of duty. And Heath wanted very much to know why that was the case. He believes it's because the Air Force suspected that the two crewmen might still be alive. He believes that Monclas and Wilson met an unusual fate. They may have been spirited away by whatever force was behind the object seen on the radar scopes that night. And he added that some radio operators he has interviewed strongly believe that the plane was swallowed up by the UFO. Moncla's cousin, Buddy Moncla, 77, who lives in the small Voyez Parish community of Moncla, said he and Gene grew up together. And he remembers he was somewhat reserved. He used to watch him play football. He's very good. And Buddy Moncla doesn't hide the fact that he and other surviving members of the family want to know what happened to his cousin, who had been studying to become a doctor at LSU School of Medicine before joining the Air Force as a jet fighter pilot. All we were told was that their plane went down. They were never found, according to Buddy Moncla's wife, Beryl. Leonie Shannon, Moncla's older sister, who now lives in Loveland, Colorado, said, "We still don't know anything about it. I don't think the government wants us to know what really happened to him." Buddy openly admits that he and a lot of others think that Gene and his plane were snatched up by a UFO. He said, "I was told that the last transmission recorded saying I'm going in for a closer look, and that's the last they heard." Asked whether he believes a UFO might have abducted his cousin Wilson and the jet in its entirety that night, Buddy Moncla just says there's no question. What else? No one's been able to prove otherwise in all this time. At the time of the Ken Ross incident, the Cold War was just heating up, and bomb shelters and worries of nuclear war were making the news. Less than 5 years after the Reds crashed the UFO at Roswell, New Mexico in 47, claims of UFO buzzing military installations, utility facilities, and government buildings and other restricted airspaces was making military officials around the world very jumpy. American jets are frequently launched to investigate stranger aircraft that seem to be popping up with regularity in isolated regions as well as overpopulated areas from California to Washington, D.C. You might say flying saucer mania gripped the nation with an avalanche of hit movies being released that made it appear the world was under attack by silver-suited aliens and big-headed monsters waving ray guns over their heads. Well, just as a footnote, Moncla's widow, Bobby Moncla Neighbors, later married an Air Force officer and lives in Alabama. Still wondering what happened to her husband. Well, sometimes disasters happen so fast, there's really no way to anticipate it. And long before the coming of the white man, a solitary tribe of Indians known as the Maka lived along the shores of the Pacific Ocean in the northwest corner of what's now called Washington State. Now, not much is known about these ancient tribesmen, except they were excellent craftsmen and superb fishermen. And they were great storytellers, a gift that's been passed down to the present generation of Maka. That's M-A-K-A-H. They continued to occupy the same region of Washington State as did their mysterious ancestors. But of all the stories handed down by the Maka, none is more intriguing than that of the day the mountain moved. For centuries, tribal elders have told the story that one day, long ago, a mud monster descended upon a tiny village of Azet, burying everything and everybody in its path. Well, there were no written records, of course. The story was kept alive by word of mouth. Around the campfires and hearths, the legend of the mysterious mud monster was told and retold. By the 20th century, the catastrophic event had become a legend firmly ingrained in the mythology of the Maka people, who continued to occupy part of the ruggedly scenic Olympic Peninsula near Nia Bay. In the late 1960s, archaeologists from Washington State University, led by Dr. Richard Daughtry, uncovered evidence revealing that the legendary mud monster was actually a massive landslide that came down the mountain, engulfing most of that ancient Maka village near Lake Ozette. For years, he had suspected the Ozette legend was based on some catastrophic event. The question was how to prove it. Like Heinrich Sleiman and Sir Arthur Evans before him, all he had to go on was a hunch that the time-honored legends revolved around a truth. And then one chilly February morning in 1970, he got what he was looking for. A winter storm had come in during the night, surging up the beach and battering the banks beyond. All night long, the savage winds ripped the shore. Torrential rainfall pummeled from above. By dawn, the storm had passed, but not before part of the beach had been washed clean by erosion. Later that morning, a hiker out surveying the damage happened to stumble upon an unusual-looking object protruding from the mud. Well, at first, he thought it might be driftwood, but upon closer observation, he realized its angles are too clean and definite to be anything but man-made. Well, fortunately for Daughtry, the hiker reported his find to the authorities. And as soon as he got the news that the storm had uncovered artifacts where in all probability ancient Ozette once stood, the archaeologist raced to the scene, shovel in hand. Well, the object unearthed by the hiker turned out to be a paddle, a very old paddle made of wood. And as he dug through that cold mud that morning, he reasoned if there was a paddle, there had to be a canoe. And if there was a canoe, maybe there were houses. And if he could find houses, there were bound to be human remains. All related to the mysterious lost village of Ozette that had been gobbled up by the mud monster. Days of digging resulted in several fresh finds. Ancient fish hooks, a harpoon shaft, part of a carved wooden box, a woven straw hat. Radiocarbon dated confirmed what Daughtry already suspected. The artifacts were old, very old, dating from a period well before Columbus's arrival in the New World. They'd survived intact because of the heavy blanket of mud that blocked out the air and kept them from decaying. While boxes of carefully marked artifacts were being filled and carted away for study, more evidence of antiquity began to surface. First, they found a timber wall, then a complete cedar house filled with cooking utensils, sleeping platforms, and personal items. Inside a 65-foot-long house were the remains of several human beings who apparently had been entombed when the wall of mud had crashed down on them. Excavations, though, were tedious. Tons of wet earth had to be removed, bucket by bucket. Carefully deducted streams of water from hoses washed clean the fragile remains of a vanished civilization. Well, the radiocarbon dated indicated that the terrible tragedy occurred about 1560, at a time when Spanish conquistadors were exploring and plundering parts of Central and South America. Other Europeans were prowling along the eastern seaboard as well, some of them searching for a northwest passage across North America to the riches of China and Japan. In time, the Europeans would reach the Pacific coast and Maka, bringing with them death and disease. Archaeologists found evidence that smallpox and other diseases introduced by European traders helped decimate Native Americans whose biological systems had no immunity to the invasion of these strange germs. In the end, once the mud of centuries had been cleared away with pressurized hoses and the ancient pieces reassembled, the village of Ozette rose once again, fresh and new in the sunlight. Fortunately for future generations, the mudslide that brought death and destruction to the Maka so long ago preserved much about their way of life, to include the remains of wooden houses, weapons, canoes, clothing, and other items that reveal what their world was like. In a sense, it was, I guess you could say, a happy ending to the tragedy that struck this village more than 500 years ago. Daughtry called the discovery a national treasure, the most significant and unique find in the Northwest Coastal Archaeology. Altogether, more than 55,000 artifacts are recovered, spanning a period of occupation of around 2,000 years and representing many activities of the Macas, from whale and seal hunting to salmon and halibut fishing. Toys were found along with bows and arrows and a variety of ordinary items used by the Maka tribesmen from that period of time. The tens of thousands of artifacts brought from beneath the mud, roughly 30,000 were made of wood. An extraordinary find since wood decays very fast, especially in water or wet environment. Hundreds of well-crafted knives were unearthed with blade materials ranging from mussel shell to sharpened beaver teeth. Established in the late 1970s, the Alzette Indian Village Archaeological Site is a living history recreation of 16th century Maka life. The Maka Museum, opened in 1979, displays many artifacts unearthed by archaeologists, as well as replicas of cedar longhouses, as well as whaling, fishing, and sealing canoes, like those used by the Maka. The archaeological site, open daily to the public, provides a unique window into the past, showing what the Alzette Maka society looked like before its destruction by a mountain of mud all those years ago. Well, from the distant past, we go to the not-so-distant past. On March 8th, 2014, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 rose into the sunny blue skies over Kuala Lumpur for its regularly scheduled flight to Beijing, China. Now, this flight would have been routine in every way had it not been for the fact that less than 1 hour after takeoff, this massive Boeing 777 vanished into thin air somewhere over the Indian Ocean. And it has not been heard from since. What followed was the biggest air-sea search in aviation history. While the world watched in fascination and bewilderment, rescue planes and ships crisscrossed tens of thousands of square miles of open ocean and remote tropical beaches in a desperate hunt for the missing airliner and the 239 men, women, and children on board. And incredibly, at the end of this massive search, officials were no closer to solving the mystery what happened to the MH370 than they were when the first emergency signal went out in 2014. In this digital age, you have to ask, how could a 300-ton aircraft and 239 people simply vanish? In an era where people can track their iPhones and Samsung Galaxy devices in real time, it seems almost incredulous that the world's most advanced transportation industry is unable to locate a piece of metal as big as a 777. Predictably, many theories have been put forward, ranging from pilot suicide and hijacking to metal fatigue and onboard fire. Some investigators suspect it might have collided with another plane or even been accidentally shot down at a secret military training operation. That's always a good solution. Blame it on the military. Others theorize the plane was abducted by a UFO or maybe caught up in some kind of extra-dimensional vortex, similar to reported disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle. Well, the search for clues still goes on, but so far, the aviation community has failed to reach a conclusion about the fate of this doomed aircraft. Now, the day it took off started like a perfect day for flying. Clear skies, puffy white clouds, and nothing but a flat horizon for hundreds of miles above the blue Indian Ocean. Less than an hour after taking off from the sun-drenched resort town of Kuala Lumpur en route to Beijing, something happened on board Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Something that resulted in the disappearance of 239 men, women, and children. 26 minutes into the flight, the aircraft sent its last radio transmission. Control towers in Australia, Vietnam, and China thought the silence that followed was odd, but they didn't take any immediate corrective action. Two of the world's most experienced airline pilots sat behind the sophisticated controls of that mammoth Boeing. Chief pilot Zahari Ahmad Shah and co-pilot Farik Abdul Hamid had flown this route dozens of times, even in weathers that would have grounded less qualified aviators. One investigator made the comment they knew it like the back of their hands. But as time went on and there was no contact, officials up and down the flight line grew worried. Aviation officials on three continents began preparing for the worst. At the time, nobody knew that the missing airliner would soon become the target of the biggest air sea search in aviation history. 2 hours after takeoff, military radar showed MH370 had abruptly left its planned route, turned around, and flown back toward Malaysia. The plane left radar screens and continued flying for another 6 hours, making satellite contact, known as a handshake, 7 times. The final handshake, made as the plane ran out of fuel, placed the doomed jetliner in the South Indian Ocean near Australia. An 8th attempt made an hour later got no response, meaning the plane had likely gone down. Well, the initial search lasted for months, eventually covering more than 40,000 square miles of open sea and land. CNN, that paragon of truth and virtue, the BBC and other international news agencies followed the search around the clock, offering updated news feeds every few minutes. Hundreds of expert panels went on air to discuss and debate the fate of the doomed aircraft. It's now been over 5 years without a trace of the plane being found. One aviation expert has concluded as if the big aircraft was swallowed up by a gigantic hole in the sky and vanished. One early theory suggested the pilot, Sahari Ahmad Shah, deliberately crashed the plane in an act of suicide. Those who embrace this belief point to the fact that Shah had apparently cleared his diary shortly before the flight. Byron Bailey, a former RAF, a Royal Army Air Force trainer and captain with the Emirates, believes that the plane was under the control of Captain Shah as part of a deliberate descent into the Indian Ocean. According to an Australian publication, Bailey said everything points to Shah hijacking his own aircraft. And this would radically alter the current search operation and potentially explain why the plane hadn't been found. Current and previous searches assumed the plane dived steeply and suddenly with nobody at the helm. Bailey theorized that Shah would have depressurized the cabin and put everybody else to sleep and eventually would have killed him before taking his own life. But if Shah was conscious, he could have maneuvered the plane in a long, slow glide, traveling almost 200 kilometers further south. And this would have kept the plane more or less intact with less debris. Bailey believes Shah depressurized the plane to incapacitate his passengers and his crew before flying the plane solo for the next 6 hours till its fuel ran out. Having sent the co-pilot to the passenger cabin on an airline early on, Zahari would have depressurized the cabin, put everybody else to sleep while he enjoyed the longer air supply in the cockpit. Another early suggestion, popularized by Russian media, claims the jetliner was hijacked by Afghan terrorists and flown to an undisclosed airbase in the mountains of northern Afghanistan. As for his opinion, John Brennan, who is been shown to be a paragon of virtue himself, who was head of the CIA at the time, said, I think you can't discount any theory. Months before the plane's disappearance, engineers warned of cracks found in some Boeing 777s that could result in mid-air breakup. 2 days before MH370 took off, the FAA issued a final demand to Malaysia Airlines after one airline found a 16-inch crack in a 14-year-old plane. In a book titled Flight MH370, The Mystery, the author argues that the jetliner was shot down by mistake and the hunt for survivors was covered up. Now, the book was published 3 months after the jet vanished, and it claimed the plane was hit by U.S. TIE strike fighters in a training drill that went horribly wrong. According to the book, if a participant accidentally shot down Flight MH370, and such things do happen. Nobody wants another Lockerbie. So those involved would have every reason to keep quiet about it. And though no terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the missing aircraft, this hadn't stopped terrorists believing there's no other explanation for the disappearance. Now, this particular theory was triggered by reports that two passengers who boarded the plane carried stolen passports. Many believe they were part of a massive cover-up to sink the Boeing 777. Of course, no one has said why they wanted to do it. Another popular theory suggests that an onboard fire killed the 239 passengers and crew and burned out before damaging the plane's exterior. And that would explain why the aircraft could fly for such a long distance off course on autopilot. Aviation officials counter, claiming that if that was the case, it would hit the water at a whopping 600 miles an hour. It would have hit the water with a massive impact as though the plane had landed on concrete. Nobody could have survived that. Patrick Smith, another pilot, has cast doubt on the fire theory, saying it's unlikely MH370 could have continued for 6 hours on autopilot after a major fire. Officials believe Shaw was unconscious, but haven't offered any theories as to why or when this occurred. And finally, late-night talk show host, those geniuses who never had their true brilliance appreciated, have suggested the plane was part of a secret warfare experiment. Others declare it was stolen and flown to North Korea. The official explanation adopted by both the Malaysian government and the Australian Transportation Safety Bureau is that the passengers and crew of MH370 are incapacitated by an unknown, unresponsive crew hypoxia event. Hypoxia, of course, is a deficiency of oxygen. The disappearance of MH370 sparked a slew of new safety proposals meant to prevent another jetliner from inexplicably vanishing. But 4 years later, the possibility for worry remains, mainly because international requirements for new planes to broadcast their location every minute they find themselves in trouble don't take effect until January 2021. According to David Stupples, a professor of electronics and radio systems at the University of London, you can't say MH370 won't ever happen again because it will. Until 2040 or 2050, there's going to be a large number of aircraft flying around that don't have the tracking system fitted on board. And according to a report by Bloomberg News, a jet cruising at 500 knots, which is about 575 miles an hour, the disappearance between 15-minute pings creates a potential search zone of about 170,000 square kilometers. That's equivalent to the size of Florida. And finding survivors in time would be equally difficult, especially in the open ocean. And sunken wreckage might escape detection for years, according to Godfrey Dell, a safety scientist at Central Queensland University in Australia who's been in air safety investigator since 1979. A few bits of debris thought to be from MH370 have been found on the coast of Africa, but no bodies or items associated with either passengers or crew members have been found. 2015, a wing flap thought to be from MH370 was found on Reunion Island off the coast of East Africa, followed by more confirmed debris from the plane. But these few pieces of wreckage do little to placate the concerns of investigators or to minimize the sorrow and suffering of family members of passengers and crew that went down in the Malaysian plane that day in 2014, I think it was. Yes, 2014. They still don't know what happened, according to the mother of one teenager who was on board the aircraft, and probably never will. It does raise interesting questions. How could something that large, 300 tons, just simply vanish off the face of the earth? Well, everybody has heard, I'm sure, of the vanished colony of Roanoke. But there was another one. It was known as Martin's 100. Now, death came quickly that cold spring morning for many of the residents of the village on the marshy, mosquito-infested banks of the James River. But an even worse fate awaited the handful of men, women, and children who survived the initial surprise attack. Before their ordeal was over, most had fallen victim to unspeakable torture and mutilation. Now, this Martin 100 was a small English settlement near Jamestown, known as Wolston Hometown. And the attack came on the morning of March 22nd, 1622. When the attack was over, 58 villagers were dead, another 20 carried off as captives, and the once thriving rival settlement of Jamestown had been erased from history. Well, the settlement's name and location were forgotten for more than 350 years. Legends remained, of course, but it wasn't until the mid-70s that archaeologists accidentally rediscovered the ill-fated village that had vanished from the historical record. The saga of Wollstone Hometown, or Martin's Hundred, as the site's now known, began with the arrival of about 220 English men, women, and children in 1619 aboard the ship Gift of God. Their mission was to settle a 21,000-acre tract of virgin wilderness and make it profitable for their owners, the Virginia Company of London. Many believed that they'd strike it rich in gold and silver, as the Spanish did in Mexico and Peru. Others believed that they were going to find a fabled passageway to the Far East. Another early map published by the Virginia Company led the settlers to believe that just beyond Virginia's valleys beautiful awaited the riches of the Orient, a few days' march from the head of the James River. But unfortunately, this was a ill-fated voyage. Some died on the Atlantic crossing, others perished from accidents and various diseases shortly after arrival. There was a brief layover at Jamestown, which had been established 10 miles downriver in 1607. My family was there. Only 140 colonists set out to build new homes in the wilderness beyond. This ranking officer named John Boys knew everybody had to work hard and fast to survive. I don't know that he worried about invasions from French and Spanish rivals, but he also had heard the local Indians were growing increasingly resentful with the arrival of so many Europeans, their version of illegal immigrants. The settlers built large palisaded walls and a lookout tower. Armor, helmets, and weapons were stored in the fort to be used in case of attack. Named their settlement Wollstonholme Town after the most prominent shareholder in the company, Sir John Wollstonholme. Now, technically, the town was part of Martin's Hundred, 100 being a British term for a unit of land capable of supporting 100 families. Other communities attempted to settle elsewhere on Martin's Hundred, but none matched the promise of Wollstone Hometown. It was believed to be a community that was going to thrive. The beginning of the end of Martin's Hundred came on the morning of March 22, 1622, when several groups of unarmed Indians arrived in town. According to survivors, Indians even sat down to have breakfast in some homes and made friendly conversation. And then at a signal, they seized the colonists' own tools and weapons and began to kill men, women, and children indiscriminately. One colonist later noted the attackers were so sardine in their cruel execution that few or none discerned the blow that brought them to destruction. Within minutes of the attack, dozens of men, women, and children had been slaughtered, their bodies scalped and mangled beyond recognition. The attack was part of a general uprising led by the chief of the Powhatan Confederacy. Jamestown residents, alerted by an Indian informant, was able to foil a full-scale assault on their town. Elsewhere, 350 settlers died, 58 amid the carnage at Martin's Hundred. When it was all over, only 62 settlers and two houses remained standing at the community once known as Martin's Hundred. Broken-spirited, most of the survivors eventually went back to England or moved away to other outposts. 1625, only 30 people still lived on the tract. By 1645, there were none. Eventually, only the name was left, and even that was altered by usage of time. When a plantation called Carter's Grove was built near the original town location, even the name Martin's Hundred vanished. The resurrection of Martin's Hundred began in 1969 after the Carter's Grove site became the property of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. 1976, archaeologists searching for 18th century outbuildings to the mansion stumbled on traces of even older structures. Convinced that there's a historical importance, the team of archaeologists under the direction of Ivor Noel Hume began excavating these structures. The work led to the discovery and eventual identification of Wolstenholme Town, the oldest planned British town yet excavated in North America. But for centuries, the remains of these earliest settlers lay buried beneath the plowed fields and expansive new forests lost to time and history. When excavation is complete, archaeologists and historians hope to know more about those doomed men and women and the world in which they lived before they disappeared from the pages of American history. Well, the, one of the most famous missing persons was band leader Glenn Miller. It happened the week before Christmas in 1944. The Germans had launched a counteroffensive known as the Battle of the Bulge. And this last gasp of the Nazi military was pushed off the front pages by the vanishing of the most popular entertainer of his day, Glenn Miller. Now, it's over 70 years ago, but the world still wonders what happened to him. He was a composer, trombonist, a songwriter, and arranger, and leader of the wildly popular sound that captivated a generation of swing music lovers. Now, most people think he died when his small single-engine plane ran out of fuel and crashed into the stormy English Channel the night of December 15, 1944. He was going to Paris to set up a Christmas Day concert for troops. But there were quite a number of other theories. Everything from a returning flight of bombers dropping their unexpended ordnance and one of the bombs hitting the plane that Miller was in, to him having successfully landed and been murdered at a brothel in Paris. He was known to be quite the ladies' man. Well, we're going to talk more about Glenn Miller and his possible fate. But for now, we've run out of time. So until tomorrow night, Monday night at 6 p.m., this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly, truly great weekend.